No, no, the women's breakfast. Okay, so we're started. Okay. Good morning. This is Marilyn Cade. I'm going to call our meeting to order. We're going to spend about an hour and 30 minutes this morning and cover a number of topics. There is a transcript for the call, and that will be posted to the, because we are going to address budget issues, that will be posted to BC Private. We're going to do the budget issues first, then we're going to talk about the policy issues that are current and before us for the rest of today and this week. We will not do actual planning for the public forum, but we will talk about the public forum topics. And then we'll talk about the BC's comments to the strat plan and the budget. Then we'll adjourn for today and we'll resume our meetings on Tuesday. So let me now please, let's do a just a roll call of who's here. And if I could please, John, ask you to start.
John Berard.
Marilyn Cade.
Benedetta Rossi.
Chris Chaplow.
Steve Del Bianco.
Ron Andruff.
Aisha Hassan.
John Nevitt.
Len Goodendorf.
Let me thank all of you for coming. And before I turn this over to Chris, I'm going to just tell you that I need to reserve 5 or 10 minutes at the end of the meeting today. But I think I'm going to take a couple of minutes to introduce the topic because I know Len has to leave and I want to introduce it. We are not going to discuss at this meeting here in Singapore the following topic, but I am going to raise the topic to all members' attention as something that we will be talking about and getting ready to talk about in Dakar, and then we'll talk about what we need to do in terms of taking a strategic look at ourselves because of the changes that will be coming to ICANN due to the new GTLD program, and what such changes may mean to the membership qualifications and characteristics of the business user constituency. The if there are a number of our members who become brand-oriented registries, then we are going to need to have a strategic plan for how we address the dynamics of our roles and responsibilities within the ICANN charter, the ICANN bylaws, that is the functional role we play, as well as how we meet the needs of the business user community who may be changing some of its role within ICANN. So not a topic for today, but something that we have to do some thinking about and be prepared to have a longer, more robust discussion and try to begin to position that coming out of Singapore and going into Dakar. So just to place that, because I know, Lynn, you have to go. Chris, we have budget, BC budget things.
Good morning. Thank you, Marilyn. It's Chris Chaplow, BC Vice Chair for Finance and Operations, and speaking on behalf of the Finance Committee, which is myself, John Nevitt, and Anders Holverston. The budget that we prepared for 2011 is on the basis of, on the income side, 50 members giving us fees of $35,900. The Finance Committee is recommending keeping fees at the present current level, the 2011 level, which is for Category 1, $1,000, Category 2, $670, and Category 3, €160. But we certainly see the need to increase the fees in 2012. 7 members joined in the second half of 2010, paying their fees for 2011 in their 2011 subscription. So it's based on the assumption that we will have some new members this year in 2011. So let's all work on outreach for that. There's no other income. On the banking side, as many of you know, one of the issues that we've had running for a long time, or as long as certainly the present ExCom have been in office, has been a very expensive temporary contract from Zaparatsi, who's actually managing the bank account as a client contract of a company account in Belgium. We've had lengthy negotiations on a new contract, trying to see if there was an opportunity to move over to a more permanent contract at a more reasonable fee. And this is one of the reasons why the budget has taken this long to prepare. And I apologise for that, but simply the situation has been changing month on month so far. The final figure that we got from Zaparatsi, the finance committee, still believe that was too expensive. At the last meeting, remember, there was some discussions about getting a USA bank account, but we were still just not comfortable with that because of getting the BC involved in the US taxation system, transferring money across to the state, the balance across to the states, and again, that the account would be in the name and address of the chair as trustee. The good news is you haven't got a holiday planned in Mexico, have you, Marilyn?
And just for the record, and what was wrong with that idea again?
Thank you. The good news is, almost to my surprise a little, but I've actually found that we are able to have a Spanish bank account, and we've now opened an account with the bank called La Caixa, which is actually Catalan for the savings box, and we've got the account in preparation. It's going to be a euro account. We've got an IBAN number, and excuse me, at this point I'd just like to thank Steve and Marilyn for the work that they went into the States, because it required a couple of visits to notaries, getting powers of attorney and our charter notarised, and with an apostle seal of the Hague to make it international. And with this documentation, then the bank account can be opened in Spain. And we've also got the advantage that it retains the account in euros, and making transfer of the funds easier. Good. So just moving on to the actual budget figures, that's the income side that I mentioned before, with a total income this year of $35,900. The expenses are in two parts. At the top there, we can read that. Yes, good. I've got the banking, again, which is in two parts. It's the first part of the year, based on what we've already paid and forecast through to the end of July, which I think we can do the transition by the end of July. Administration, website, meetings, outreach. I'll move on and then come back to this if anybody wants to ask me about it in more detail.
And Chris, just for the record, well, this is proprietary and confidential. For any member who wants a copy, they can email you and you'll forward a copy, a PDF version, to them, right?
Yes, I'm quite happy. Rather, as it is proprietary and confidential, I decided not to print out 50 copies and hand them around today and leave them in the room and things like that. So equally for this and the other report that we've just finished, which is the 2010 annual report, that if any member wants a copy of that, the budget and actuals for 2010, plus an accompanying report that the Finance Committee prepared, then just ask and we'll send them a copy of that. Good. The forecast costs for this year, $56,021 there. And what I actually did was I put in the first part of the expenditure and everything really that's necessary expenditure, and at the bottom expenditure that's really a wish list, that were things that we wanted to do, were in earlier versions of the budget, but at this point, unless we have some more income or things go better than predicted, We can't spend those until we've got some funds for that.
Do you have time for a question, sir?
Yes, Steve, go ahead.
Steve Del Bianco. Chris, I was wondering, on a run rate, on a go-forward basis, is the 56,000 euro what you would expect once you've settled out all of the Zaporizhzhia expenditures and come up with a normalized run rate for expenditures? Do you think we'd be lower than 56?
I think 56 is about right. I think it's not likely to be any lower, and equally it's not likely to be much over. It's best prediction I can do.
Right. Without any of this officer travel.
Chris.
Yeah, there's no officer travel in there. The officer travels on a wish item down there, but there is secretariat travel in the core expenditure. Yes, Lynn.
Would you mind going back to the first
Yes,
page?
Certainly.
Yeah, I would just mention that because I use hosting services for my own business website, that the fees being paid there are a little on the high side. I mean, it's not a drastic difference.
I think I should respond to that, Lynn, because I moved the services away from our secretariat resigned with no notice. And we had to move and completely rebuild. And we actually have a very intensive ticketing process by which we have to make changes. And they also maintain multiple lists for us. So we could reduce in a particular area, but we would. There are certain services that we can't. Running list is not simple. So. We're using a particular service. We will be assessing at some point. It's unlikely that ICANN is going to deliver usable services for us because they don't do things in a timely manner in this kind of service, but we will be assessing at some point whether we could move our web pages to ICANN. And they do maintain one list for us, which is an archive, which is a fairly expensive service. But that was why we ended up with that particular service and why we haven't explored and spent the time of moving around or taking the responsibility ourselves for trying to do it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Lynn. If I just add to that, the mailing list item on there is, I'm hoping that won't be in next year because I'm hoping we can move that across to ICANN on the toolkit. The hosting will probably keep where it is. The updates is a little bit on the expensive side.
Yeah, what I was going to mention, yeah. The main difference that I see there compared to what I do with my own small business,
yes.
Is that I'm using a service where the website updates are incredibly easy to do, and I do them all myself as far as updating content. So I'm not paying that website update fee. But I only mention it in passing to just say that, you know, maybe in the next year there's some opportunity there.
Yes, no, it's a fair comment, and thanks for bringing it up. On the updates, Chris Chaplin speaking. Yeah. The ICANN provided community wiki is now operational. So what Bernadette and I are going to build a quick structure for that, and as many of the updates as possible will be done on the wiki, which will be no cost. Actually, because of Benny's hard work and all the changes that we've had recently to the website and all the updates, that is actually what's increased the cost on the changes. So by moving that work across the wiki, keeping the website itself more static until we move on to a new content management system. So I hope we won't reach that cost, but it won't be there next year. Yes, Ron.
Ron Androff. Just the banking Zaporizhzhia, $9,000, that, if I understand that correctly, is because there was the issue that we've been wrestling with, where to put the money and how to deal with that because of our structure. But are those are fees for an individual to manage, and will those go away? I just need just clarification on that.
Okay. What happened was, at the time that Gary resigned without notice, and So there was no secretariat for 3 months. He continued to hold the bank account, and Mikey and I convinced him to resume the banking services. But he would not, but he insisted on a very high fee of 250 euros a week, and then an additional 150 euros for an hour for any work that he did. So we had a very, and it was intended to be temporary. But we tried to transfer the banking to ICANN, and that is really not feasible. We then started the exploration of moving the bank account, and we were told by a number of other constituencies who have bank accounts in a different setting and by ICANN themselves that they thought we could transfer the banking account to Washington, D.C., and Chris and I actually went to two banks and tried to do this. Because of what the banking oversight rules after 9/11 changed dramatically, and we can't transfer in that amount of money. We also can't, without triggering an IRS investigation, we also can't open, we can't get a tax ID without becoming subject to potential tax liability. And as Chris said, it was going to have to be in my personal name with a an EIN number, and my home address would have to be used as the location. I then explored with an attorney and an accounting service whether they could provide the service. Same problem with transferring the funds. So we had spent more time at that level, Ron, with Gary, because we couldn't find a cheaper alternative.
And so that was my point. So then for going forward, that's an amount of money we will not be spending. Is that correct, or we will have to spend it on something else? On Benedetta. Okay, so that goes that way. Okay, that was what I was trying to get clarified. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So to move on and to resume, that leaves us for this year with a predicted budget income of 35,900 and a cost of 56,200. And projecting that forward, the balance in the bank at the end of the year will be 37,900. Now, the Finance Committee draw everyone's attention to a clause in the present charter that is establishing a reserve equivalent to at least 1 year's operating costs. Now, projecting those figures forward, we see that the reserves at the end of the year of 37,000 will be less than the operating costs, which are, I'd say, a little on the high side this year because of the banking, etc., 56,000. That gives us fundamentally three choices at this point. One is to look to amend that clause in the charter, which is something that I know is in plan anyway. Another will be to raise the fees this year, and the third, at least theoretically, would be to reduce our core costs down to that. What the Finance Committee is recommending that the members approve either an amendment to the Charter, if that's needed, or some sort of variance exception clause this year until we actually approve a new charter later in this year, because the thought was that the two-thirds annual costs was a better reserve to have in the charter.
Chris?
Yes,
this is Lana. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to leave to go to the Who Is review team meeting, so I'd just like to say before I leave that I strongly approve reducing that reserve and doing whatever amendment is necessary. That seems like a really excessive amount of money to have in reserve, and it's just not a good use of money. So,
yeah. Thank you, Lynn.
Thanks very much.
And can we just pause?
I think it's a tight budget, and you know, the only wiggle room I see there is in the in the web type support and services. Otherwise, it looks very tight to me.
And thank you for coming. It's Marilyn speaking. And Lynn is going off, for all of you to know, to spend her day on the Who Is Review team. And we'll be coming to meet with you on Tuesday.
Yes.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Lynn. Just to go forward to 2012 quickly, we'll probably come back to the other point, but an outline forecast for 2012 would see a further drawdown. Now, obviously, this is not acceptable to do this year on year, so the Finance Committee are recommending that the fees will have to be increased in 2012.
May I make an observation, Chris?
Yes, certainly. Go ahead, Steve.
The increase that you showed for 2012 is an increase assuming that we continue to work the reserves down. But if we just on a go-forward basis, if we wanted to bring in enough revenue to match the 56 expenses, it'd be a 20,000 euro increase. And that's 50%. It's roughly 50%. So either we have 50% more members or 50% higher dues or some combination of the two. So I'm asking whether the Finance Committee is thinking in terms of trying to work to the reserve or work in terms of having income equal expenses on a go-forward basis.
You're quite right, Steve. In ballpark figures, yes, there's about 20,000 there or 50% in balance at the moment. So what the Finance Committee thought was that this year it's a little bit late to ask members to raise the fees, and as Lynn pointed out earlier, there's this feeling that the reserves are at this present time slightly higher than they need to be. So this year we would bring the reserves down to 2/3 of the costs, but next year there will need to be an increase. And yes, I did a calculation, it's something like 45%, but you're right, of the order of 50%, which I understand has been a historical situation. Marilyn, is that the case with the historical fee levels?
So very quickly, it's Marilyn. The historical situation was when we founded the BC, we had no dues at all. And when we established dues, it took quite a long time for people to pay. And the BC incurred a debt of 100,000 euros split between two parties, one being the ICC and the other being a service. They were providing services to us and doing invoicing, but we had about a year and a half period in which we were beginning to collect dues. The secretariat services were incurred for 2 years, and we had no revenue. So what happened, and I was not an officer at the time, what happened when I became an officer is that my feeling was that we had to deal with that. So we established a payback plan, and we negotiated with Zaporozhye to become the secretariat, and we paid a much lower fee for the first year while we began to pay down that debt. So it took us several years to pay down that debt, and as a result of that, the officers at the time felt very strongly that we needed to have a year's operating reserve. That was because we had a debt. We didn't change that when we got out of the debt situation. So we just transitioned the year's operating expenses without really, needing to, perhaps. But so I think this is the time to take it down to a more reasonable level. To your point about when I became chair, Mikey was the vice chair of operation and finance at the time, and we proposed to the members, with Gary Zaporozhye's support and agreement, we proposed to lower the dues because we were about to have 100,000 U.S. cash, 80,000 euros in the reserve. And so Gary's proposal to us, and we did put it before the members at that time, was to lower the dues on a temporary basis. The dues are actually proposed by the Finance Committee and then presented to the membership. So the normal dues are 1,500 euros, 750, 500. We lowered those and have kept them at the lowered amount. So 50%
increase.
Yes. So we could, if the Finance Committee proposed that we take the dues back up in 2012, that would begin to equalize the, and if we are successful in growing our membership, then we will go back to a revenue meets expenses environment. Sorry for the long answer.
Good, thank you, Marilyn. Is there any more questions at this time?
Do you need are you requesting a motion to approve a variance and or change the charter? Is that what you're requesting here?
We've either got to change the charter or request a variance for this year. I'm not certain on the legal side in terms of the charter itself, whether we do actually need to, or that we can let the members be aware that there is a variance there, and if the current work carries on with the charter, then we'll change the charter this year. And as John has pointed out, the actual balance in the bank doesn't drop till the end of the year, so actually the problem doesn't occur when you put it on the timeline. And so, with that in mind, whether we do actually need a motion now to change the charter, I'm not sure whether we actually need to go to that. Yes, Marilyn. Sorry, it's all right. So I think what we've just got to basically do is discuss that in the XCOM and take advice on that, Steve. If we've got to actually formally change the charter, then we'll put a motion to the members to do so. If we don't have to, then it's just an XCOM variance, yeah?
I actually think, it's Marilyn speaking, I think that actually we need to modify the charter before the end of the year to two-thirds. I don't think we need to modify the charter on a temporary basis, but we need to modify the charter in September when we do the election for the councillor and the nominating committee elections, that we need to put before the members any modifications in the charter. There's another modification in the charter, which is a minor change, but it basically says that it assigns some of the responsibilities that are carried by Chris, and it still uses the word secretariat. So developing the budget and approving the budget, it says it's done by the secretariat. It's actually done by the vice chair. But we have a couple of minor changes like that, and then we would have this change as well. But my proposal would be that we make that change, we make any changes at one time, so the members are not piecemealed.
Yes, that's right. There's certainly a number of minor changes that are needed. But in passing this budget now, we're certainly committing to do that job, which is a job that we need to do anyway, but it commits us to do that this year. Yeah, thank you. No, so did that, I think that answered the question then, Steve. Yeah. Good. Well, with any more questions? If not, I'll wrap up.
I just have one. Would you just briefly explain to the members, Chris, the proposal that we made to ICANN for funding, what that was for, just very quickly, so that later, if members see it, they understand it's not on the budget and why it's not on the budget, the $20,000 fellowship program?
I've actually got that in the other presentation later on, so okay. I'll bring it up then if that's all right, yeah.
Then I'm going to just ask for if there are any last questions for Chris. Otherwise, there will be a meeting report that will be public, but this part of the meeting will be on BC Private, and so that we'll have our public meeting. There'll be a brief announcement in the public meeting report that says that the members present received a presentation by the vice chair, discussed the following topics, but it won't go into detail since these are considered membership topics. And I'm going to go to Zaid for one final question, and we're going to move to the policy topic, if that's okay.
Thank you, Marilyn. Just hearing the discussion on the finances and amendment of the charter, here are my thoughts. From what I understand, I think we're going to be increasing our cost and spending over the next coming years. That would mean that in order to be able to balance that with the income that's coming in, because income is either going to go down, maybe it's going to go up, or at least hopefully remain the same with the revenue that we get. I mean, not income, but revenue. In that respect, it does sound to me like a sensible plan to maintain the charter where it is, which says 1 year reserves of cost. If we are going to sort of understand that this year or the next year we're going to have difficulty because we are sort of breaching that as a deficit, et cetera, fine. Maybe what we could do in the charter is sort of create a possibility for an exception to be created where members vote and say, well, yes, we understand the exceptional circumstance this year, and so fine, we can go below the 1 year cost equivalent. Maybe that's one way to go, just to be careful about the reserve limits. That doesn't mean that we can't do it and we're stuck with the one-year reserve. It just means that we just have to go back to the membership and get that approval, and it goes outside the finance committee. It's just a thought. Thanks.
I'm going to respond to that, Saeed. It's Marilyn speaking, because we did discuss this in detail beginning at 8:30 today. We have a rationale, and as you know, this came up in the executive committee. We have a rationale for why we're lowering the amount. We received advice that it's not a good idea for us to hold this amount of money and that we run the risk of creating the possibility of an audit, a tax audit. So lowering the reserves to two-thirds is still going to mean that we have roughly 40,000 euros, roughly, in the bank, and that's two-thirds operating. We will be, as I said earlier, we will be asking the members for any amendment. So I think we're going to meet your objective of making sure that we're asking the members for approval. I'm going to close this off, and we're going to go to a policy discussion.
Thanks, Marilyn. Steve Del Bianco, Vice Chair of Policy Coordination. This morning I emailed to all of the members the policy calendar for this week. And if you could reference that on your own machine, it would be a lot easier than having to read it from the screen. But just the same, Chris and I put an abbreviated version up here to walk through. There are only, at this point, 5 open public comments, Channel 1. I wanted to start by acknowledging Chris Chaplow was able to complete and submit consensus BC comments on the fiscal year 12 operating plan and budget, and he got those in on Friday the 17th. So the 5 open comments right now start with travel support guidelines. Let's see if we can scroll down a little bit lower. And Chris has volunteered to lead the drafting of BC comments on travel support. We have new GNSO policy development process. I have yet to hear any interest in commenting that from the BC. I probably will want to probe Mikey to see if he's interested on that. The GNSO policy development process, Marilyn, are you aware of member interests in commenting on that one?
So that process, John Berard is our official designee to that working group. And I've been a sort of part-time observer. I'll turn to John as well. There's a few things. If you remember, Philip was the person who I think indicated some interest on that. He's actually probably our most experienced member in this overall thing. But that's the PDP, right?
And we did submit comments on the preliminary report. Right. What we have now is a final report.
Right. But I'm thinking, if you don't mind, to ask Philip's guidance on, because I've gone through it. John, I think you've gone through it. It's very detailed. It's designed to, and if you're going to review it, there are 2 parts to it, and I would say read the implementation manual, if I'm using that term right, John. It's like, yes, you read the implementation manual part. There's really no need for you to read the huge detailed report before. If you read the implementation manual part, it's actually a lot more digestible, and it tells you what you're going to have to live with.
Okay, so I'll take that as an action item to talk to Philip, as we did last time. And you know Philip, he's famous for his very brief comments. Is there anyone else on the BC who wants to work with Philip in digesting and commenting on that? I'll take that as a no.
So the one related question, back to your point about Mikey, the thing that's in this is the reliance on the working groups and that particular, there's implications for the BC in how the working groups are set up, whether or not they have accountability, whether there has to be a designated representative from each constituency in order to make sure there's balance. I do think, John, that it behooves us as the BC to look at those working groups, because Mikey's feedback, Barry's feedback, I think my feedback, and John, I don't know if your experience is as well, we can be outgamed in the working groups. So maybe that section might take particular focus, and there I do think Mikey and Barry are probably and Chris, who's been on a working group, maybe the most recently experienced with that.
Great, thank you. The next is by July the 15th. Go ahead, John.
So for those who are interested in jamming needles into their eyes, the presentation of this will be at 2:45 this afternoon in the GNSO Council session. You will also be getting from me in the near term a copy of a work in process of regarding the establishment of guidelines for cross-community working groups, which is now underway in the council. Jonathan Robinson of the Registrar's Registry's constituency has got the point on it. And there are, I think, some significant overlap between the role and the construction of working groups, the clarity of charter, and the value of the output. So if you could just keep an eye on those two things.
Steve?
Thanks, John. Any other questions?
I'm sorry, yes. I just wanted to follow on to John Barrard's comment, Ron Andruff. I'm a little confused about maybe terminology, but we moved from a model before where the GNSO Council was voting on everything to a working group model, where we had work teams developing different things, so that the GNSO Council became a body that would kind of assign tasks to working teams, and the working teams or the working groups would come back with information, and then that would move up and become approved or not. Now we're talking about cross-constituency working groups. Is that the same thing as working groups, or is that a different thing than I'm really confused.
Well, I share your confusion, and I can assure you that many of my colleagues on the council, I will absent Zahid because he's been at this a little longer and probably sees things a little bit more clearly than I do. But the council is responsible for policy related to generic top-level domains. It has instigated, reviewed, and then forwarded those recommendations as policy to the board. In the current environment where the issues are more complex and touch upon more of the SOs and ACs, there is a tendency for there to be at the working group level not just participation but now chartering by more than one SO and AC, and this is driven mostly by the joint applicant support cross constituency work team, which wound up operating under charters from the GNSO Council and ALAC that were different. That difference then, of course, led to disagreements, and it was thought that the smartest thing to do would be to establish some guidelines for what now, having been used three times, will likely be used even more in the future as the issues become increasingly complex. But the focus of the GNSO Council is on policy matters related to generic top-level domains. Other ACs have the opportunity to offer advice and counsel in their own way. But the board seems to be quite supportive of the collaboration occurring at the community level rather than having to be backdated at the board level.
That's Merrill? Helpful. So that brings some clarification. So if I understand that correctly, then that means that it's not really cross-constituency working groups. It's cross-SO or community working group. So it's SOs being involved with the GNSO, other SOs. That's the kind of thing that you're talking about? Yeah. And ACs, of course. So I'm a little less confused, but still somewhat confused.
The purpose is that, just structurally speaking, the work teams, et cetera, that you refer to basically are under the umbrella of GNSO, working on GNSO charter mandate. Anybody can join, but eventually whatever decision the council will take will be restricted to the council's decisions, and that'll be under that umbrella. When you're going cross-constituency, where they actually were, you're right, it's a misnomer, effectively. It's cross-AXO. So ACs and SOs. So what you then have is a representative of the GNSO or representative of the ALAC or representative of other NSO, et cetera, being in that group, SAC, for instance, and them together as like the JIG, the Joint IDNs Working Group, and then the JAS, which was for applicant support. So you had represented from every AXO being in there. So that's a structural difference. And it's important that we do this, as John said, because we've had some difficulties with the GNSO and other AXOs where you've had two charters or three charters, depending on what that joint working group was doing, and then you've had disputes, effectively, as to where the result goes. And maybe one organization wants to send it to the board, the other says we haven't approved it, and then you've got this sort of stalemate. And then you have politics taking place around that. So that's why what John is talking about, the work that they're doing, is going to be extremely important to try and sort that out and not have two charters or three charters.
Thank you.
Marilyn?
In the discussion yesterday, and I'm not sure I feel like, I want to applaud our two counselors for your tolerance and how the discussion, both the preparation yesterday and also the discussion with the board went, because I don't think that the council distinguished itself in how it handled the discussion with the board, for those of you who were here. But the board seemed to be indicating an awareness that in such groups, it will become important to have a lead from a particular group. So if we take DSSA as an example, DSSA, the lead work was done by the CCNSO. And then they recruited and brought in other groups. So I think we're likely to see something that looks a little bit more like that model evolving in the future on. But DSSA is not a topic that is about GTLD policy. It is about a larger issue. So the other question about the cross-community working groups is really a more complicated question about probably have to have space. So we have preferred to have a designated representative to make sure that our water is carried in such a group. But the group may be open to a random number of other players who are unaffiliated, maybe with any group. So this paper that John is circulating, I will pay some attention to it, and I would expect some of the rest of you to be really interested in it, because there are going to be two, at least I would say, two types of groups. One is one that touches on GTLD policy, which has implications for another SO, such as the CCNSO, and that may be a new who is standard. But another example may be SSR overall. And if there's a cross-community working group on that, then we would expect to see the ASO involved, the ALAC involved, potentially the root server group involved. So that will be an even more complex working group environment. So I think, you know, while the council is going to be trying to develop a set of framework thoughts or guidelines, I don't think it's going to end up being even the development of the criteria for working groups is not likely to be limited to just the input of the CC of the GNSO. And that's my understanding, John, to just verify one of the points that you made yesterday, is once the council has a straw document, there's going to be an effort to circulate it more broadly.
You know, I haven't talked to Jonathan or haven't seen his work plan, but it strikes me that it'd be hard to implement cross-community working group guidelines without talking to the other groups.
Okay, thank you. Before I move on to the next item, with respect to number one, the travel support guidelines, if any of you are the least bit interested in helping to digest and comment on that, please give Chris. Marilyn's volunteering? Excellent. So Chris and Marilyn so far. Thank you. On item three is a opportunity to comment on the preliminary issues report on the UDRP. And the preliminary issues report was the first step in a PDP process. And there was quite a bit of discussion on this yesterday. Lisa Cooper had volunteered to be the lead drafter for the BC comments on the preliminary issues report. There are no motions, no votes scheduled on the UDRP preliminary issues report this week. And you'll see as I scroll down in just a moment, I wanted to have a substantive discussion on sort of where the BC has been with respect to UDRP and to try to encourage broad participation in this, because July 15th will sneak up on us. So we're looking for ELISA to circulate before July 1st, so we have our 14-day comment period. And you'll see from the – I actually sent an email out late yesterday afternoon sort of recapping where we've been on UDRP, particularly within the context of the RAP report. So I'd like to come back to that and just cover 4 and 5 and come back to the UDRP, because I have specific notes under GNSO Council in Channel 2. So let me skip to number 4, which is the Who Is Policy Review Team discussion paper. It's right there, number 4 on the screen. We are needing to submit a comment by the 23rd of July, and it's going to be important to get a volunteer from the BC to go through that paper. We have frequent commenters on Who Is and huge supporters of Who Is, and the BC was instrumental at scoring 3 new Who Is studies since the San Francisco meeting. I mean, what a turnabout. In San Francisco, we got nowhere, and the registrars effectively shut down any Who Is studies. But in the time since then, 3 new Who Is studies were funded and approved by council. John and Zahi did a lot of work on that, and a small work group met with Liz Gaster and staff, and were able to pull that together. Is that a volunteer?
We have Who Is rapporteurs. Sarah George, they're on our website. So maybe the question is to see whether any of them are actively willing to contribute.
Absolutely.
And then add to that, I mean, I think the other thing that we should introduce is there is a, I believe that Lynn or Susan.
They're on the actual review team.
That doesn't mean they can't work for the BC on our comments. So could you check with them and see if either one of them are interested?
I will check again. It's going to take – are there anybody here that wants to volunteer to be part of the drafting team for our comments on this?
You can just follow up with Sarah, too.
Yeah. Okay, the next one is joint applicant support. They produced a second milestone report, and again, it's focused heavily on trying to find ways to assist applicants who want to file applications but lack the expertise or the financial resources to get them in. On the Channel 2 for Council, John, I noted that Mary Wong is circulating a potential motion you may even consider under all other business on Wednesday. That'll come up in the next channel on this. But what's here is well over a month from today, on the 29th of July, we have the opportunity to do a public comment on that second milestone report. Last time around for the joint applicant support, we focused on an established BC position to support incentives for applicants to be able to do lesser-served linguistic communities with additional versions of their TLD. Ron, this is a topic that's, I know, near and dear to you, so I certainly would hope you would consider taking the lead on commenting on number 5. It's quite a bit of time between now and the end of July.
Thank you. No, in fact, Andrew Mack and I had drafted that bundling letter that we had circulated, and we've discussed posting that. And so, in fact, we would bring it back to the BC to add any comments or thoughts to the preface to that. So, thank you.
That's great. Yeah. So, early part of July to circulate something within our 14-day deadline would be fabulous.
Will do.
Thank you. Thank you, Ron. John.
So, the text that Mary is circulating is not a motion. It's essentially a pledge of loyalty to the concept, born out of what the council believes is unfair criticism regarding its handling or not of the second milestone report. So it may be meaningful only to us. It really shouldn't and likely won't have any kind of substantive impact.
John, I didn't see it on the all other business for Wednesday's agenda either, so I was a little confused. Thanks for clearing that up.
I think she's just going to, as soon as she gets people to agree, yeah, I'm okay with it, she'll just circulate it.
Thank you. Chris, we scroll down to Channel 2, which is Council. So there's 2 elements to the Council part. The first is later today. There's a work session for Council in this room starting at about 10 o'clock this morning. And what I've listed here are the agenda items so that you can plan your day accordingly, whether you want to be here to watch John and Zahid at work. If you can endure between 10:30 and 1 o'clock, a discussion of the new guidebook as well. Zahid, that would be an opportunity to focus on things that it's possible that the staff and board would do further accommodations of the GAC's request to tighten up the rights protection mechanisms, to look at a review period a year after the 75th TLD. And this is something we discussed on the BC member call on June the 13th. So there's an opportunity there to weigh in on what, if any, changes are expected today when the GAC and the board actually meet. I did paste into the bottom of this memo an actual summary of the way in which the GAC is proposing to change. And Chris, if you don't mind scrolling to the very bottom, please. Thank you. Just a little bit higher than that where it starts with. There's five elements. So a little higher? Thank you. So the GAC has said on page 5 of its comment, its latest scorecard, that it wants 5 rights protection mechanism changes in the guidebook. And I'm happy for insights from any of you that have talked to GAC and board members. Does the GAC board discussion later today, are they going to substantively deal with the remaining scorecard items that the GAC has in front of it? Are there any insights here? Marilyn, please.
At the risk of everyone in the room becoming excessively depressed, I'm still hearing that there are at least 2 showstopper issues. They're issues that the board can resolve. The list that Steve has there, and Steve, I'm sorry, I can't. It's the consensus. Sorry, this isn't going to work.
And it's in your email that I sent this morning.
No. That the item that's not there is the. No, the GAC issue about how to determine consensus, and that it is the GAC who will determine how they determine consensus versus the board telling them. That is the major showstopper issue that I'm. So there's 2. That is the major showstopper issue for all GAC members, as far as I can tell. There is a showstopper issue for 32 countries, something like that, and that is the use issue.
These number 3, the use issue is up there.
Right. Use, I think, they can resolve. The other issues, they can resolve. The one that I would say they can come to compromises with the GAC on these other issues, and the issues that are there for the most part are consistent with the concerns of business users for the most part.
Yeah, what I did in this exercise was the executive committee had asked me to go through the GAC scorecard and to pull from it items where the BC has established positions and interests so that we could see where else the GAC is pressing for things that are either in support of or, in the case of number 3, in opposition to a BC position, because number 3 up there is the opposite of what the BC had asked for.
It is, but just if we could just ask in the room, if the for whatever reason we took a position opposing it in the future, if the GAC wants that and that takes an issue off the table that allows the DAG to move forward, I would question why the BC would continue to oppose that. There's a different point about the determination of consensus, because one of the issues about determination of consensus is that a very limited number of governments want to say that if a single government objects, that has to be interpreted. They have this bizarre. There's no active opposition, but if there's at least a couple of governments who want to say if a single government objects, that means there is no consensus and therefore the name can't go forward, that there would be a presumption that the name would not go forward. That particular area may be more troublesome for the BC.
And the BC doesn't have a position on any of that, and I guess the news here is that meeting between the GAC and the board might be preoccupied with the issue of consensus. So the likelihood of resolution to 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 is relatively low. I wanted to scroll down to the next item here because the GAC sort of suspects in its scorecard they're not going to get 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So what they've proposed is that 1 year after the 75th new GTLD is launched, the GAC proposes a formal review on these three items we just went over. And the assumption is that a formal review would determine whether the process is working as it's supposed to. And if it isn't, they would expect a mid-course correction in extending TM claims to run longer than just the sunrise after 60 days, to use more than just an exact match for a trademark clearinghouse on TM claims, and the question of whether use is requirement to get into the clearinghouse. So this is relatively novel, this notion that 1 year after the 75th TLD is in, there would be a formal review, a timeout, if you will, and it would result in a review. Presumably the community would participate in this review, and if it came up with any recommendations to change the code of conduct and the registry contract, it's my understanding that the way the registry contracts are written, that everybody would have to abide by that change. So I would certainly hope to hear discussion of this afternoon. It's one way they punt the issue a year and a half out, because they won't have to actually respond. Sorry?
Add VI to your...
VI, vertical integration, okay. Yeah, so they may decide to punt this issue by agreeing to a review at some point a year out. Any other comments or questions on that process, the notion of a review 1 year after the 75th name is in the route? Okay, great. And they also made points about compliance, which is consistent with the BC, and applicant background screening, that it include consumer protection deceptive practices. Are there any other comments with respect to the GAC meeting today? Marilyn?
Just one. So the other success, though, that I think the BC should be happy about is in the present version of the DAG, there is now a requirement that the applicant describe, and I'm going to say this roughly, Steve, but Ron or somebody can perhaps correct me, that the applicant describe the population for whom that they intend to serve, and that's very consistent with existing BC positions and recommendations. We supported the idea that the applicant should be able to describe. It's not a full business plan, but it does describe what the target registrant. The second thing for this afternoon is I suspect there will be some discussion on VI. The recent letter, because I think some of the governments feel that the DOJ letter was, particularly the paragraph, which describes the fact that the competition authorities are not the suitable punch-to place, and that they're not established to fulfill the mission that ICANN has been suggesting that they would provide consumer protection. So I think that will be a topic of discussion and debate in the afternoon session.
Thank you. They may also bring up the latest notice of inquiry from the U.S. Commerce Department on the IANA functions contract, which includes some proposed new language on assessing serving the public interest before new strings are put into the route. So that may come up as well. But those are both unilateral moves by the U.S. government, not necessarily GAC items per se. All right, so the rest of today's agenda with GNSO Council includes a working lunch where they're going to talk about preparation for their meeting with the CCNSO, IRTP presentation of a final report, policy development process team, and I think we have a presentation. Okay, that's it. Okay, great. So let's move to the next channel, which is the council meeting on this Wednesday in Singapore. So I've listed here all the items on there. The first one is this UDRP. So I did want to get into a little bit of a substantive discussion on that so that we can understand where the BC has been on UDRP and encourage a lot of participation to work on our report, which will be done in response to the preliminary issues report. So in our comments on the RAP, the Registrant Abuse Policies, the BC supported a recommendation to initiate a PDP on the UDRP. and we said we support the recommendation to initiate a PDP by requesting an issues report, and that is what staff has done. They've done an issues report. And so at this point, the BC is on record at supporting the beginning of a PDP process, but I did want to point out that now that we have a preliminary issues report in hand, I think the BC's position on whether to proceed with the PDP should be informed not just by our RAP position, but by looking at what's in the preliminary issues report and evaluating whether it serves the BC's interests to see a PDP. And there was a lively discussion yesterday about whether a PDP on the UDRP could cause the UDRP process to become weaker or potentially to become stronger. We don't know which way that's going to go. So I wanted to get a better sense of the discussion from the folks around the table about who's interested in participating with ELISA, coming up with our position on UDRP. Take a cue.
I was going to say I was interested in working with ELISA on that, but in addition to that, I think you must have heard what we were discussing yesterday. The IPC, even some of the BC councillors and others, sort of spoke to the concern there may be with trying to tinker with the UDRP at this stage, specifically since with the new GTLDs coming out, the representation made to brand owners was that, look, you have the UDRP, so you can deal with all the problems. We're going to give you an accelerated version of the URS to deal with any further problems you may have. And so that's where we're going to go into the new GTLD, protecting your rights. Now, once we've built upon the basis and working in the IRT and the STI, I remember whenever we used to discuss what are we going to do in the URS or PDDRP, there was a consideration of what the UDRP was now. So how I see it is that we've built the URS and the PDDRP on the basis of the UDRP. If we start tinkering with that, it naturally means we're going to have to make changes to the URS, et cetera, which I don't think is going to happen at this stage. And what I understand from the NCSG, et cetera, they're looking for the opportunity to be able to have the UDRP debate opened up. And when it does open up, I mean, there will be several individuals who want to sort of change certain substantive aspects of it, not just procedural, substantive. And that's why the debate on the council list, for instance, has said that, okay, anything you do with the UDRP means you have to have a PDP, a full-fledged PDP. And the PDP will mean everything's open for debate. And it's difficult then to say, well, don't touch this area because that suits our interest. It means although we may gain some benefits, we also may lose something. So I just wanted people to be aware of that.
Mikey.
I just wanted to get in the group, that's all.
Mikey, thank you. Barry Cobb is on the phone and listening, and I know you and Barry worked very hard on RAP, as did, where's Martin? As well.
Barry's not on the phone, but we're trying to make sure he gets on the phone.
Yeah, Barry's Skyping with me, and he said he was dialed in. I don't think he's dialed into this meeting. He's dialed into something else. But Mikey and Barry, I want to make it clear that the BC's adopted positions with respect to, hey, should we do a PDP on the UDRP? Let's be clear. That's what it is right now. We support the idea of starting a PDP with an issues report. Now that an issues report is in hand, We are still on record as supporting a PDP. So if we want to go soft or change the terms, that's why I'm glad to sign you guys up to decide whether we're going to proceed that way. So Mikey, and then I think Chris, Marilyn, and Martin. Go ahead, Mikey.
This is Mikey. I think that we've fulfilled our position, which was we supported an issues report. So I think that position is now complete. We can basically start with a clean sheet of paper. The bewilderment I feel right now is the amazing Alice in Wonderland job that the staff did on our humble little recommendation in the RAP. We weren't talking about blowing up UDRP. We were talking about fixing little technical edges, and this thing has sort of run away. So I think if it stays as runaway as it seems to have, then we just say, no, we're against it. But I'm happy to join the gang and find out more. I fell asleep yesterday, so I couldn't sit through the madness and the GNSO meeting, so I'm not up on the latest nuance. But clearly the intent of the RIP group was not to open up the UDRP for a complete rewrite. And if that's where they've taken it, then I think we've got to back them out of that hole.
Thanks for that clarification. The words on the paper were a little bit more ambiguous because it says we support the initiation of a PDP by requesting an issues report. And I put that in bold in the email I sent around this morning. The BC also has one other written position that Phil Corwin led for us last summer. Do you remember last summer when there was a public comment period on whether to approve another vendor to provide UDRP? Remember that? And a few of you guys worked on that with Phil Corwin. I thought it was a really good collaborative effort. And that put the BC on record as suggesting that there ought to be a standard contract and a standard selection process for your UDRP vendors. And let me, before I get back to you, Mikey, Phil Corwin wants to work with Elisa, okay, on that aspect. And I asked Phil last night, what is your position on whether everything else should be touched in the UDRP? And Phil said, no, I simply want to focus on the project we did last summer, which is a standardized set of selection and contracts for UDRP vendors. So I think Elisa would welcome that kind of help because the BC would have a substantive comment at the end, at July 15th. And I do hope that we can come to consensus on whether we want to see a PDP. Now, we had Mikey, Chris, Martin, John, and Frederick. Did you put your hand up as well? Okay. So, Mikey, you were going to finish your point?
This is Mikey again. I think that probably what we should do is approach Phil and see if he can roll in with the rest of us because I think
he's already agreed to do that.
Okay, because it's all the same thing, and that's it.
Yeah, thanks, Mikey. He even emailed me this morning and said, "Count me in for that."
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I'll offer my help on that as well. Having survived a reverse domain hijacking, I've got some experience there. There was one thing I did wake up yesterday at one point when I heard the statement that the UDRP is a very inexpensive process. That, of course, depends exactly where you're sitting. And if you're sitting from the point of view of a small business, which many of our members are or represent, then it's not a very inexpensive process. Thank you.
Chris is not being as direct as he could be, but he runs Andalusia.com, and the government in his area used a UDRP proceeding where he was the target and had to be the respondent. So his perspective on dealing with it, I think, is valuable, too. I do hope you'll be able to put some time in on this process.
So I'm just going to say two things about the UDRP. Historically, something that people should understand is the UDRP did not spring from a policy development process in the same way that you presently know it. The UDRP was written in as a concept coming out of the white paper based on an international consultation, so the requirement for a mechanism to deal with what we then called collisions between domain names and trademark law was put into the requirement to ICANN to have a mechanism. There was a six-month WIPO fast-track study that Sarah Deutsch and I and others who are here, and I see Claudio De Gangi is here as a guest, were heavily involved in helping to inform that international consultation. The output of that six-month process came to ICANN in a working group, and I can't remember whether it was A, B, C, or D, but there were working groups, and it was that process which created the UDRP as you now know and live with it. So it was the early version of policy development process. So those of you who encounter in the council today this pushback about how to revise policy, et cetera, there is a historical aspect to this, and Mike Pelage actually was chairing one of those working groups. So I just, if you need that information, that's a resource to you. And the second thing I would just say, if you have not had a chance to review the webinar transcript, that webinar was one of the best, most well-done resources that I have experienced. And I did not participate in the webinar in person, but I did read the transcript. And if you're interested in the topic and were not able to participate, you should invest your time in at least scanning the transcript. It's very informative.
Thanks, Marilyn. And Martin Sutton, you are a member of the RAP team.
Thanks, Dave. Yeah. 2 points that I just wanted to flag here is that when the RAP was actually up and running, at that time, it was envisaged that new GTLDs were imminent. So, you know, timing-wise for UDRP review may well have been timed about right. So that's one point. The other aspect there was that the discussions around UDRP included the fact that they weren't, the UDRP itself isn't effectively a deterrent for cyber squatting. And now what we're seeing with URS, some of the changes imposed there where loser pay mechanisms are being considered and built in, is far, far better now in terms of adding supplementary tools rather than just relying on the UDRP.
All right, thank you.
One more point is that I put my hand up to join the team.
Fantastic. Thanks, Martin. So this is not on the agenda for today. This is Wednesday's agenda. And John and Zahid, it's on for discussion of the UDRP, PDP, but there's no vote. There's a preliminary issues report. Comments will come in. But I would encourage members of the BC who were so active on the RAP team, please try to be at council on Wednesday afternoon. So when it's time to discuss that in council, some of you folks who actually put pen to paper and came up with recommendations can speak to them. I think the timing issue is important. And then Mikey trying to clarify whether, you know, the issues report satisfied what the RAP team asked for or, in fact, was a full-blown PDP, what you've anticipated all along. So I wanted to move on. Marilyn?
But I really think we need to spend a couple of minutes on this issue of risk. We do, because if the BC members are going to speak about their view about the timing of opening up a UDRP, I think we at least need to park the topic that there is risk to opening up the UDRP, and there is a timing issue. So given that we don't have a thorough assessment of what that risk is and what the timing is, I am actually very cautious about whether it is a good idea to do anything other than administrative assessment. And I think we need to at least talk a little bit about administrative improvements. The question of what those are and what you can do outside of a PDP, I think, is a gray area right now. Would that not be right?
Okay. Agreed. It isn't what we have in writing as our adopted position, so that's why it's essential to get that worked into the discussion and through the BC position adoption process so that we can revise our position from what it is we adopted with respect to the RAP. John Berard had a comment.
Sure. At yesterday's GNSL Council meeting, Christina Rosette from, what's her law firm? She's a lawyer who deals with many of the UDRP hearings, and she put the average cost at $4,000. And, you know, for me, $4,000 is a lot. For, you know, I guess for everybody it might be a lot, but for some people it's not that much. But when you have 10, 20, or 30 of them that you're pursuing, then it, you know, starts to add up to real money. There is in the report of the staff a change circumstance, which I think is important to appreciate, because it, I think, allows us to gain some of the, if not all, of the improvements that the RAP working group sought without having to open a PDP. If you haven't looked at the appendix to that report, in which there are three policy recommendations that would require a PDP, but then there are three or four pages of process improvements that could be undertaken without having to engage a PDP. I think that's an interesting approach to allow implementation to deal with some of the rougher edges that that we've been focused on. And I just wanted to encourage you to take a look at that if you haven't at this point.
Thanks, John, for bringing up the issue of dollars. I mentioned that Chris Chaplow had to defend a UDRP proceeding against AndaLucia.com. He ended up spending $50,000 to defend, not $5,000, $50,000 to defend himself when the regional government of Andalusia pursued it. And I'm not talking dollars. These are euros, real money. And Chris prevailed, which is good. But I think all the insights, the BC has incredible depth of insights on UDRP, from protecting brands, to protecting Chris's own business, to the RAP. So let's all team up on this so we can get a good set of comments. So let me move on now. The rest of the agenda for Wednesday's council meeting, you have an IRTP final report and recommendations. John, Zahid, that is a long, complex, and Zahid, that is a long, complex motion, your IRTP Part B. Do you two have any need for clarification or support on how to vote on Tim Ruiz's motion?
Yeah, there was some debate yesterday about a Resolve C, which talked about the possible review of the UDRP. It referenced the possible review of the UDRP, to which the IPC obviously raised an issue saying, where did this come from? And so it did actually come from the report per se. Apparently, it was sort of an outcome of discussions and sort of an interpretation of discussions. So I think that the IPC made the comment that if this was out, it would make it easier for them to vote for it. I made the comment as well, understanding what the reason for that was. And now my understanding is that it's twofold. One, it implies that there will be, or the council does understand or approve that there will be a UDRP review, number one.
And Zahid, may I ask you something? Sure. As I read the resolution right now, it says, if a review of the UDRP is conducted in the near future. So the word if was in there.
Absolutely. But it does imply that, number one, that there may be a possible review on the way. And so the council acknowledges it, at least tentatively, if not on a fixed basis. And the second was that, does that mean that the locks don't come into place when there's a dispute at the moment? So that's a question mark. That's a gray area, because it sort of implies that when you go into the UDRP dispute, the register lock is not in place. And so there were two basic policy reasons where I think I would agree with the IPC concept on that, yep, sure, maybe if it's not referenced in the issues report, we shouldn't even mention it in the IRTP resolution. But it would be nice to hear what members have to say, especially those who are on the IRTP.
So Zahid is speaking of a potential amendment to the resolution with respect to the UDRP and the locking. So we'll take a cue on that topic, because you're going to need to make a decision on whether to accept the amendment and vote in 2 days. Mikey and John.
And this is Mikey. I was on the IRTP as well. This is another one of those ones where my recollection's a little fuzzy. Martin, you may be able to help me, but you know, I thought that the IPC gang was kind of the ones that brought this up, because what we had there was another one of these administrative issues in which, and I was talking to a couple of registrars about this last night as well, where there is gray area with these locks. I think that in terms of the vote tomorrow, if it turns out that striking that issue, the item C, is the way to get this passed, that it's a non-material change to the work of the working group. It was something that we stumbled across. We parked it in the report that way, but if removing it allows passage, then I would emphatically support removing it, because it wasn't the key thing that we were working on.
Thank you, Mikey. Let's make this brief. We only have 9 more minutes. John, and then over to Zahid.
I would expect that we will see a friendly amendment to that motion that excises C and also deals with the other concern, which was a PDP for Thick Who Is, which point was made that you're really only talking about a single vendor with regards to that. So why not, you know, try and deal with that directly rather than go through a PDP process? So I would expect that we would see a friendly amendment excising those two bits. And I did speak with Mikey yesterday, and so I was able to sleep a little easier last night, because I figure that that's one less person who will be mad if we still vote for it without those two bits. And then with regard to the UDRP, I expect that that we will see coming out of this meeting a collaboration between the non-commercial stakeholder group and the registries to move forward a motion on a UDRP PDP likely the next GNSO council meeting.
Can they do that even though we are in the middle of an issues report review?
I've seen no bar against that kind of behavior.
They may do it. They probably are going to have to, technically, legally, they're going to have to wait for the public comment. But it may mean a red flag to those who have a different point of view. about the public comment process, public comments that are submitted.
All right, Zahid, last comment on this. Go ahead. Thank you. We only have a few more minutes left. Let's see what else is on the agenda for council. This consumer trust, choice, and competition topic will be discussed in a workshop on Wednesday at 12:30. It'll also be in the council meeting Wednesday afternoon, and it's a discussion of how to respond to the board's Cartagena resolution on asking for definitions and metrics for consumer choice, trust, and competition, since the affirmation of commitments calls for a review of those same three metrics at least a year into the launch of new GTLDs. Philip Shepard on the BC had undertaken to draft, and all I've done is summarize for you here the three definitions that are in that draft. Now, there is no public comment period out on this. This was the BC trying to get ahead of things by developing definitions that could be useful. And, Philip, what I've done here is excerpt that I have your paper attached to this morning's email, but what I did here was excerpt the three single-sentence definitions. And I mention this because we have volunteered to help Rosemary Sinclair with the workshop she's doing Wednesday. And if we're lucky, we'll have an opportunity to have a representative on her panel. If we're not on the panel, we can certainly make comments from the audience. But the BC is going to need to debate substantively the definitions and metrics for competition, consumer trust, and choice. And I think that we're not going to be able to do it in this meeting because we're running out of time, but I'll bet we can do it on our Tuesday session. So with your indulgence, let's make some time on the Tuesday BC meeting to have a substantive, calm discussion of these three topics. Marilyn's thinking no room?
There's no time, but I think the point is we may need to find a different time and we can do that.
Great. All right, so that's it for that. Let me scroll down. Mikey, you're going to give an update on item 8 on Wednesday afternoon on DSSA. Anything you want us to tell us about that now?
Just really quickly, I'm reading the document that John just sent about the guidelines for cross-community working groups, and that's actually going to be a topic of my update since I'm the... I think I can even promote myself to being the senior co-chair of this working group now. So this document is very helpful, and I am really interested in the cross-community working group guidelines thing since I'm running one. So that's all I wanted to point out.
Thank you, Mikey. Marilyn, did you want to ask for topics for the public forum? Because CSG needs to submit them.
So, guys, I sent an email out, and I have gotten a couple of answers, but we have the opportunity to propose topics. They have to be submitted through the CSG, so that'll be Tony Holmes who submits them on our behalf by close of business tomorrow. You may want to wait till tonight's meeting with the GAC to formulate your thinking, but do start thinking about what you think you want to put on the agenda. The other thing I would just mention to all of you, and I did post this to you, the ATRT report seems to be out. You just can't identify it because it's on the Affirmation of Commitments page, and it is not probably the detailed analysis you were expecting. But you may want to take a look at that because that is one of our topics with the board. So you may have a little homework to do. And it's not hard to find, but, you know, we thought the report was not out. It's a one-pager, and it probably doesn't meet. There is a Excel spreadsheet which lists all 27 of the topics and gives the board committee to whom the assignment is made to deal with the topics. So since ATRT is one of our board topics, I think you got a little work to do to refresh yourself on that.
And Marilyn, the board agenda for their meeting on Friday does include three items I wanted to call everyone's attention because we may want to speak to them. One is the ATRT implementation. The second is .NET renewal. And if you remember, the BC strongly requested a thick who is. When it didn't come out, I wrote an email to Kurt Pritz and John Jeffrey saying the BC, I reiterated the BC's request for who is, and I wanted to know, did staff request that VeriSign put thick who is. Third element is the FY 2012 budget, and Chris has submitted a substantive comments from the BC, so I do hope, Chris, you'll be able to go to the mic and echo some of that on the public forum. And that's it for the policy.
And so we have one question quickly from Chris, and then we're going to move to Chris to review the comments on the budget. Yes, Chris?
Yeah, I was just curious. You had said you were going to talk to Denise about the ATRT implementation. Have you had a chance to do that and get any more info?
Sorry, that was the answer. There is the one page. Sorry. Thank you, Chris.
Great. Thanks, Marilyn. So, quick review on the draft FY12 operating plan and budget. That's been open for public comment. The public comments closed Friday, the day before yesterday, just ahead of a board vote next Friday on that budget before it takes it, precedence on the 1st of July. So, it's a very tight. Those were the comments that have just been put on the public forum. Not very many comments, actually, when you consider it's such an important issue. We commented in four specific areas on the process, on the advanced leadership requests, the specific support requests, and we made some general comments. Just to take us back to last year, the FY11, the process was very frustrating, and the issue was raised many times at the Brussels Forum, because the FY11 draft budget was approved in entirety by the board, so we all came away thinking that any comments we'd made, both written and orally, were just a complete waste of time. Mm. And that wasn't us, that was all the parties felt that. And we were advised by Kevin Wilson, the CFO at the time, that any substantive comments, in any case, would have to be raised much earlier in the budget cycle if they were to be used. So we were all excited in Cartagena by these new process enhancements that we saw, and these were the three enhancements. One, earlier strategic plan, an opportunity for the leadership to submit their requests earlier, and also the framework to be able to participate in setting support levels prior to the framework. Skipping the first one for now, the process enhancements. This hasn't really appeared to have happened. The process has been set down, and I think we were the only constituency to actually take this one up. But nothing really happened. It seems to be forgotten. So I'm asking that this initiative should be given a second chance next year rather than just quietly dropped. That might be partly because of the change in staff, but we've got to draw attention to that one. We also, the three areas that we used our opportunity for advance commenting were compliance, and we've got good news there, as you may have seen if you've read the budget, that the compliance has been increased by about 25% on the low that it was. And remember, FY11 was a bit of a low year, so everybody can spin and say, oh look, haven't we got a great increase on the previous year, but of course FY11 was a sort of historic dip. But it's good to see that we've got an increase on compliance, and also on the staff numbers that, according to the budget, are returning to 15 in compliance, where they had been down to 12. And just quickly to pull out, there's a focus, there's no money against it, but the focus on the operating plan of the ticketing system for compliance, so that they can actually report properly to the different groups of where the problems are, and that's the famous Mikey letter that came out of the IRTP working group as well. Staff support was an area that we were pushing for as well. 6.5% increase in there, so that's good news as well. And in the assessment of the comments on the framework, this time it wasn't just a summary of comments, there was ICANN, a response and rationale in that, and that's interesting and worth reading, and I think it's good that there should be some rationale explanation in there. And one of the comments that was made in that was, remember, if something untoward occurs in policy development, then it's always an opportunity to go back and ask for funds out of the contingency. Mm-hmm. And remember this, I just can't remember the actual details. There was some issue, wasn't there, and Liz Gaster Catherine? Got a little bit upset because how are we going to deal with this? But there is a mechanism there, and it has been...
The consumer trust and confidence.
Consumer trust and confidence, thanks, Steve. So there is a mechanism there, and just remember that that is in the back pocket should these things come up again next year. This was the third area that we highlighted, and things do seem to be progressing on that. Difficult again trying to work the numbers out of the budget, and there's a sort of questions on this slide about different numbers in different parts. We've got the three who is studies, and there seems to be 672 against that, but that is other projects. I think it's the way the budget often works. It says who is and others. We know of about 530,000, I think, on the who is studies. So there's some questions there we've got to ask. Moving on to the other area, supported services. This is where the constituency leaders were asked for areas that they wanted to have support, direct support. We repeated our request that we in the toolkit, and there seemed to be a sort of a dual process here, and that was the toolkit of services for the telephone, for the website, for various initiatives. That was a policy staff initiative, and I noticed in the FY12 budget the toolkit is clearly under policy development support and not under the additional requests in the budget. So the toolkit actually comes out of a different section in the budget than from this one. And we look forward at the Singapore meeting here to having some details about what is going to be available to us from the toolkit. But as far as we know, everything we've asked for has been accepted on that. The list of support requests makes interesting reading. To say the least, yes, most of the it rather looks like most of the constituencies seem to have asked for, you know, can we have a YouTube video and can we have this and can we have that. It does seem very detailed. It's also interesting to see what's been accepted and what hasn't been accepted, but we now understand that the document that's currently published in the budget is not correct. It's the wrong version or an earlier version or something. So, and some groups have been granted things. They must have got very excited when they saw what they had in the budget and have since been told that, unfortunately, it was a mistake and they're not getting that at all. There's a little bit of confusion on that, so we don't know. The area that we did ask for, we asked for a 20,000 allocation for the constituency based on a pilot project for outreach for this year. That was rejected, and because that was basically the main and in fact the only area that was requested within the support, we're very disappointed that was rejected. We've had calls with the controller ahead of this meeting, and we'll have another meeting again, and as I said, the whole thing's been thrown into uncertainty because the published document was in fact not the correct one. So we'll continue to push for this item. Do you want to say anything about the explanation of this item, Marilyn? Yeah.
We're going to need to wrap. The idea of the $20,000 project for outreach actually is a would involve the identification and financial support for participation for business leaders from developing countries. And this is something that we've been working on. There's been input for it. It is not approved. We are, however, going to be encouraging businesses from developing countries to apply for the existing fellowship program as an interim step. And so if you come from a developing country and you have contacts with particularly business associations that you could encourage to consider applying for the next two meetings, we will need to have a particular set of activities ourselves that justifies if they're awarded fellowship training. They would go to day one of the fellowship program, and then they would spend Tuesday with us all day, and selected parts of the rest of the week with us. So they would it would basically be in partnership with the fellowship program. That item, that $20,000 allocation of funds to all of the constituencies, is back on the table for consideration for next year's budget, and we will be discussing that at the CSG level with the other constituencies, because the IPC did request $30,000 of travel support, and the ISPs also intended to request funding. The NCSG also did request various services. So you'll hear more from Chris in the future about how we would address that. If we get funding, it would be for a specific project, because we have to be a little careful that we don't come under a lot of scrutiny by ICANN about our own separate budget, and we don't want oversight or reporting by the BC to ICANN about how we manage our own budget. That's a shared concern by the registry and registrar constituencies and the IPC as well. Zaid.
Thank you. My basic question is, was there a reason given why the pilot project was sort of funding was rejected? But I wanted to speak to the follow-up point of the fellowship. I know that, at least for my country, one business applicant for fellowship was rejected. And instead, we've had 3 years running the government representative, a telecom regulator, coming on the fellowship program. So on the one hand, we don't have the funding, because it's not been that's been declined. On the other hand, if we have to sort of rely upon developing country businesses to rely upon the fellowship program, the question that I wanted to ask was, do we have any sort of an understanding or with the fellowship program that business would be given preference? Thanks.
Yes, we do. And that developed out of the last two meetings. And I've spent quite a bit of time with Mandy and with Janice. And that's so the present understanding is, if we have a few identified applicants that we're sort of saying they're ours, and we would describe how we would mentor them and do something with them back in their country or region. That so the part of the problem is the independent panel of selectors has a particular lack of information about the challenges for small businesses to be able to afford to travel. But I think we're working on that.
Thank you for picking that up, Marilyn. Really appreciate that.
Okay, we're going to wrap up. I have just a quick thing to remind everybody of. And Benedetta has pieces of paper that if you are interested in writing a personal note to Peter, Monday night, the BC will have a social event with the board from 6 p.m. to 7:15. We have agreed to share that time with the ISPs. But it was originally a BC social event with the board, but in order to make sure the ISPs who hadn't had a social event, we are giving the board a memory book. And Benedetta is printing out, you can come in. Benedetta is printing out pictures of Peter and you that have been taken by Michelle at other events. So the memory book will have pictures. If you want to autograph the picture when she brings them back, I really hope you'll do that. But there are pieces of paper, gray and white, very good quality stock, for you to write notes to Peter. The memory book allows you to just insert, so whatever you want to write, you can insert, and then we will give that to Peter, and we will have some extra pages for anyone who doesn't write a note ahead of time to be able to do. It is a social event with the board, so that part of the event is going to be no more than 10 minutes, because otherwise it will compete with the purpose of the event, which is your opportunity to network with the board. But if you would see Benedetta and get paper, then you can write your notes yourself and then bring them back to her, and then she will get the pictures and insert them in with a background. I need for you guys to do this, otherwise the memory book is empty. So a couple of other quick things. You know, our breakfast on Tuesday morning is with the ALAC, and the topic is a discussion. Your primary purpose of that breakfast is networking. So you will be seated with at least two representatives of the ALAC. There's a officer from the CSG at each of the tables as a sort of an anchor host. Benedetta has seat assignments. The ALAC is filling in the seats. There, folks, you're going to be asked to talk about what is ICANN's role in acting in the public interest. So this is not a conversation about metrics for consumer choice. This is a conversation about acting in the public interest. And what do we each think it means? It is a conversation. The second purpose of this is for you to have an opportunity to identify a couple of areas where you think that the VC, the ISPs will be there, the IPC will be there, have commonality with the ALAC around particular concerns. And then we go to the CSG meeting, and at 11 o'clock we go to meet with the board. We come back, conclude the CSG meeting. We will meet, we will resume in the BC at 1:15, not at 1 o'clock, so you have 45 minutes to grab a sandwich. And then we will hear from our nominating committee representatives in a conversation about whether the nominating committee process is really sustainable and is it fulfilled, not the appointments they're making, but more about, learn about the process. When we then go from 2 to 3 to meet with the Who Is review team, and then we come back and conclude the BC meeting, and I'll be posting the agenda. We have two sets of speakers. We will hear, you'll meet the full compliance team at 3:05, including the new director, and it's very likely that Jeff Moss will stop in and meet with us, and we will hear from our SSR team, Jeff Brueggemann and Scott McCormick. And I think we probably need to wrap now, but you'll see the posted agenda. Yes, Ron.
Just one question on the agenda, Marilyn. Looking at the Tuesday schedule that's posted on the website right now, it says that on Tuesday from 5 o'clock to 6:30, there's a board GAC open meeting on Tuesday afternoon.
That's true. There always is, and we will be breaking.
That's the standard meeting?
Yes, that's the standard.
That has no impact on what's happening on the GTLD thing and all of that. That's going to be behind us, and theoretically it's just a normal meeting. That's what I wanted to check. Thank you.
It's the rest of the agenda.
Thank you.
Okay, we can stop the recording. Thank you. Benedetta will be working on the meeting report, and we will resume and see you guys, see you for the rest of the day as we work together here. And thank you for coming out. My apologies for having to make these changes, but we had 2-hour-long meetings interjected into Tuesday, and I think Steve and I and Chris felt that we didn't want to miss the opportunity to